In 1986, James McGill Buchanan was awarded the Alfred Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. He was recognized for his work in developing a theoretical framework that extends the tools of economic analysis into examining how political decisions are made. This work has come to be known as the Public Choice School of Economic Theory. Public choice theory, as pioneered by James Buchanan, provides a deeper understanding of how government policy is affected by the self-interest of politicians and other political and economic forces. In a way, his interest in both economics and political science are quite fitting. The son of Scotch-Irish parents, James Buchanan grew up on a large farm in a rural and agricultural area of Tennessee, very near the site of a pivotal conflict in the American Civil War, the Battle of Stones River. Although poor, his family had considerable status in their small community, largely because his grandfather had served as governor of the state of Tennessee. The family expected that young James would follow his grandfather's example.
I was groomed to be a lawyer, in the sense I was groomed first to be a politician, to follow in my grandfather's footsteps.
But the Depression altered those plans, as Vanderbilt University became too expensive for a family of limited means. Instead, Buchanan attended Middle Tennessee State Teachers College, largely because it was nearby and allowed him to live at home, where he could earn money for fees and books by milking dairy cows. Buchanan wasted no time in distinguishing himself as one of the finest students at the college, and after receiving his bachelor's degree in 1940, he was given a scholarship to the University of Tennessee for a year of graduate study in economics. He received a Master of Sciences degree in 1941. Plans to continue his graduate training at Columbia University were cut short by the prospects of the military draft. In August of 1941, Buchanan volunteered for service in the U.S. Navy and served 4 years at Pacific Fleet headquarters in Pearl Harbor and Guam. In 1945, he faced what he later called his only real career choice, whether to stay in the military, as he was urged by his superiors, or leave it for further academic training. Intrigued by the exciting intellectual climate he had heard about at the University of Chicago, Buchanan left what had been a very satisfying service in the military and embarked for his PhD studies in economics in the Midwest. While at the University of Chicago, he met Frank Knight, the famed economist, who was to be his greatest teacher and mentor. In Knight's price theory class, Buchanan was converted from his early belief in populist and socialist ideas. He became, as he later called it, a zealous advocate of the market order. Since then, James Buchanan has devoted his life to studying the fundamental structures of political and economic decision-making. Through such works as his classic The Calculus of Consent, written in collaboration with Gordon Tullock, to The Limits of Liberty, published in 1975, to The Power to Tax and The Reason of Rules, both written with Jeffrey Brennan, Buchanan has continued his push for new ways to approach these abiding questions. Liberty Fund invited Professor Buchanan to a conversation about his life and work with Jeffrey Brennan, his longtime associate, co-author, and close friend. Jeff Brennan is professor of economics at the Australian National University. In this program, which is part one of the conversation, they discuss the theory of public choice, Buchanan's exchange theory of economics, and constitutional thought. In part two, the conversation turns to such topics as the work ethic, the logic of free markets, subjectivism, anarchy, federalism, the Nobel Prize in economics, and Buchanan's personal experiences and philosophy. we welcome you to a conversation with Professor James Buchanan.
Jim, in 1986, shortly after you'd won the Nobel Prize, Alastair Cook on Letter from America described public choice as the homely but important truth that politicians are, after all, just the same as the rest of us.
Yeah.
What do you think of that as a description?
Many people interpret public choice in that way, and that's certainly a central part of it. But in a way, I always think that that's only part.
Right.
Politicians and public choosers in all respects are just us, like the rest of us, and therefore motivated in the same way that we are. But with that standing alone, I don't think you have public choice. I came at it with a view of criticizing basically welfare economics,
right,
or public finance economics, and this assumption of the state or being benevolent, government being benevolent, which was naturally foreign to my thinking. So in one sense, that kind of a negative view or critical view of the sort of idealized version of politics in the state is very central to my own contribution.
Right. Yeah. Now, you say that was alien to your thinking at the time, the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, where did that thinking come from?
Well, it's very difficult to know what the origins are. I've described myself in my autobiography. I described myself as before I went to the University of Chicago, I was a libertarian socialist, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but actually there was a political party in Weimar, Germany that was called libertarian socialist. But I was libertarian in the sense that I was always anti-government, some people controlling other people. But I was socialist in the sense that I didn't understand how markets worked, and I thought the Wall Street barons were running the world,
right,
and therefore maybe something like social democracy would be better than what we had. And I just didn't understand how markets can coordinate things. And
right.
So in a sense, the libertarian part of that libertarian socialist, which I was before I really learned economics, stemmed, and I think this is important, and it did stem from my basic cultural heritage,
right,
as a Southerner,
right,
as three generations away from a war in which we were defeated. I don't think I could have ever been, under any conditions, a sort of a strong nationalist, pro-government socialist,
mm-hmm,
in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that does explain a good deal of,
mm-hmm,
of why I came at it from the way I did.
Let's talk about the public choice bit that's left over, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think the bits that aren't, as it were, reactive to political idealism involve? I mean, the pure science, as it were, of politics.
Well, you see, you go back to this very first point about public choice is simply modeling politicians and bureaucrats and like the rest of us.
Right.
That is, there are no particular saints, any more saints in politics, probably less than there are elsewhere. But that's not enough. If you start thinking about politics that way, then you sort of you have a very empty type of theory. So you have to come and try to explain political structure, political order, from some sort of perspective that will give you something other than simply an empty theory or empty box. And there I've always thought that the thing that must be added to that must be this notion that at some ultimate level people must enter into political arrangements for mutual gain. There must be a shared benefit from being involved in organized government. So in a simple way of putting it, I've always thought of what has to be added to that first sort of politics without romance sort of thing.
Right.
That's the first part. The
right.
second part is politics is in some ultimate sense an exchange process.
Right.
That is, you have to enter into a shared enterprise with other people, and I think without that, you have no means of justifying any political coercion of one person by another person. And you and I were just chatting earlier about why did Joseph Schumpeter have such small influence in politics, in public choice.
Mm-hmm.
You can go back and read in Schumpeter's Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, a book that was published as early as 1942, you can see almost all the precursory elements of this first point about politics. I mean, he modeled politicians and bureaucrats very much like what public choice does. But he had very little influence. Why? The answer was he had no hope. There was no hope there. There was no, it was a council of despair. If you looked at government that way and that's all you saw, you don't have any answers. I mean, and of course Schumpeter was an elitist. He wanted people like him to run the world. But that's the reason I think he didn't have any influence. You need to add to that. You need to add to that, sort of be very skeptical about the motivations, about the behavior of politicians and bureaucrats, but also recognize that, in fact, there can be gains to all of us by sharing in a political enterprise. And we can lay on, or we can construct, we can work out schemes whereby everybody benefits. Everybody puts in and everybody benefits. What I would call a kind of a Madisonian vision
right.
needs to be added to make public choice complete,
right.
I think.
So you're, it sounds as if you're actually quite sympathetic to those critics of public choice, or at least a piece of the public choice apparatus that sees public choice as eroding social trust and... I mean, you know the Mark Kelman argument about this. There is an anxiety around that public choice really destroys the faith in democratic processes, and by doing so, undermines something that's necessary to maintain it.
I can understand it, on the other hand, without accepting it. I can understand where that criticism is coming from.
Right.
And in a sense, it destroys a faith, but that faith is based on an illusion.
Right.
The illusion somehow that governments are benevolent, the illusion that politicians are saints. Now, I think I have ultimately enough faith in the wisdom of the ordinary people to think that we don't necessarily have to have such illusions. We don't necessarily need to be under those illusions in order to recognize politics for what it is.
Okay, so let's come to this issue about exchange, mm-hmm. Because that is an important part of your whole scheme. Not only in relation to politics, but also in relation to economics. I mean, you've argued in What Should Economists Do, for example, that we ought to background the whole maximizing enterprise and foreground the exchange dimension.
That goes back to this libertarian strand. That goes back to this notion somehow that there is no justification for anybody coercing anybody else.
Right.
And if you're not going to coerce people, how do you get people to do something? You exchange with them. You give the reciprocal relationship of one person with another person, and you build that up, and you start getting that more complex and more complex, and you ultimately end up in which we're all participating in a big exchange, and if we're sharing a commonality of a government, of politics, and so forth and so on. So I don't think that necessarily stems from anything other than the sense that how are you going to justify any coercion if you say, no, there's no coercion justified on any ground? And you see, unless you can bring in some transcendental purpose, how can you justify coercion? Unless God is, there are God's rules or right reason or something, if you say, no, values start with us, they start with individuals, then how can one individual legitimately coerce another? And trained as an economist, starting thinking about exchanges, then it's easy to move into this sort of exchange version of politics, the theory of voluntary exchange, so forth, as politics. Now, economists, I think, went down the wrong path when they got attracted by the calculus and started talking about maximizing, settling things at the margin, because that lends you directly into an alternative view of a way to look at the world.
I mean, I wondered whether one important aspect of the exchange versus maximizing notion was that exchange is relational. You know, you need two people to exchange.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there's a centrally sort of social element the account of exchange, whereas in maximizing, Crusoe can maximize on his island.
Exactly.
So, but then I wondered whether perhaps methodological individualism, in a way, connects to this thinking about exchange. That is, the idea that the problem with the maximizing paradigm is that it too easily becomes we maximize, or society maximizes, or the economy maximizes.
I think it's all tied up together. I don't think there's any way to separate it out. You go back and the fundamental unit of consciousness here is the individual, and everything starts from the individual. That gives you the methodological individualism aspect.
Right.
And no individual can legitimately coerce another, so then necessarily you have relational dealings here, relationships, I started to say. And so it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And once you slip into the maximizing notion, Crusoe maximizes on his island, and then you had somebody, you had Friday and so forth, it's easy to slip to talk about them maximizing some joint value or something like that, which need not exist.
Quite so. So does this, this emphasis on methodological individualism and the nature of individual interaction explain, in part, your enthusiasm for game theory?
Game theory is probably the most important contribution in economics in the last century. Matter of fact, I've written a little piece on that, making that argument. And it's for that particular, exactly for that reason, because game theory, you see, in an ordinary game, neither player is choosing the outcome.
Right.
The outcome emerges from choices made by different players, giving the alternatives that each faces. They each make a choice, an outcome emerges. The outcome is emergent in the sense that it's not chosen by anybody. So nobody is maximizing in a game. Nobody is maximizing whatever comes out. And you can model economics that way. If you and I are trading apples and oranges, we end up stopping trade, and you have so many apples, I have so many oranges. But that's not That's not a maximum of anything. It's just that I'm maximizing what is my utility by trading so many apples to you, and vice versa with the oranges to you. But out of that emerges an outcome, and it seems to me that that's the proper mindset for this sort of relationship that people have with each other. In the trade relationship and all other relationships, you have outcomes that emerge. Outcomes aren't chosen by particular people. And that is where game theory, it seems to me, gives you the proper formal mindset for understanding an exchange relational process. Whereas if you take this other view, this maximizing view, you don't have that.
No. Let me ask you a question about some earlier work that you'd done on the public debt. Let me see if this is right about that work. That the real problem with the conception of the whole debt issue was a false level of aggregation. That to take the remark that people often passed about internal debt, for example. That internal debt was debt we owed to ourselves. Well, I mean, an obvious question coming from an individualist point of view, I guess, is, well, what's this we business?
Yeah, right. Well, this gives me the opportunity to say something here, generally speaking. I've been around a long time, and I don't think modern economists or others can possibly appreciate the level of thinking that went on in the 1940s, not only about this, but about many other things. The naivete that was present in the thinking of so-called sophisticated economists there, it's unbelievable today.
Right.
It's just unbelievable. And so to think of the academic, intellectual attitudes that were pervade about public debt in the 1940s, in the post-Keynesian period, it's very difficult for us to get in a mindset where that's obviously stupid.
Right.
It's obviously stupid.
Right.
And yet that's the way people taught it, that's the way it was in the textbooks, that's the way people believed. You see, the idea was, you go back to what you said about aggregation, the idea was somehow that if you simply look at nothing but resources and don't tie those resources to people, that actually you're using up the resources all at the same time. So therefore, how could you have a gross burden in the future? Uh-huh. But that's failure to relay anything back to individual choices. And uh-huh. And all I did was to spell out that in fair detail.
Sure.
It turned out that had been the strain in the literature. There were people who had that right, but then you'd had a strand amongst economists all along who'd slipped into this aggregation fallacy. Mm-hmm. And then this aggregation fallacy became dominant in the post-Keynesian world, because the Keynesian implication for policy was you need to create deficits. Again, it was stupid. You didn't need debt. You could do it with money,
sure,
even under the Keynesian scheme.
Sure.
But if you forget about that, the idea was you needed to have debts. We were in a permanent recession. We had too much saving. So we need to have government-run deficits. So therefore, you need debt. Therefore, you couldn't argue that a debt was a burden. So you wanted to argue it was no burden. So
sure,
it sort of the normative purpose of the Keynesianism fit in with this fallacy of
right,
aggregation. And so you
right,
got this dominant view that was really dominant when I studied this stuff, that there was no burden to debt whatsoever, so
right,
so on.
You said on a couple of occasions to me in relation to principles courses
and
textbooks and so on,
yeah,
that a real measure of the success of the book is how quickly it gets to exchange. And if you have an awfully long time of maximizing and the theory of the firm and so on before you get to exchange, that's not a good idea. And, having read now your What Should Economists Do, that fits to me.
Von Bawerk, a famous Austrian economist, had the idea that you start out economics by talking about two horse traders,
right,
trading horses
right,
with each other, and that's the way you start. And I think that's the way to start. Or to use a geometrical term, you start with an Edgeworth box, that is where you have two commodities, two people trade, and you get. And I think that's a better way to start, and that fits in with the earlier comment about the game theory, because here you have these people coming together, interacting, and out of that something comes out.
Sure.
And I think that's really a better way to start. And as far as I know, no textbook really has yet developed that fully.
The market looks like an instantiation of exchange, and one can understand somebody who is an exchange-oriented person or a contractarian, as one might call it, being a fan of the market. The application to politics, in a way, seems on its face a bit more strained, don't you think? I mean, politics looks like intrinsically a coercive enterprise. It looks as if there have got to be winners and losers. One team wins and the other team loses. majorities, exploit minorities, and so on. Doesn't it need an extra dimension of imagination and perhaps explication to see politics as exchange?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And also, there's another aspect that ought to be mentioned here. I said that conceiving politics as exchange is, in an ultimate sense, is part of public choice.
Right.
And that's properly true. But also, politics is many other things.
Right.
And a lot of these approaches are simply alternative and complementary ways of looking at the same phenomena.
Yeah.
Some part of politics is pure conflict. That is, I'm trying to get take it away from you, and you're trying to take it away from me through through organized politics.
Sure.
Other part is simply some people enjoying the power of coercing others.
Right.
Certainly those models explain much of politics that we
yep.
see. And this is, I did learn this from Frank Knight, go back to Frank Knight again. I think he was in turn influenced by Max Weber.
Right.
Strongly influenced by Max Weber. And that is, you work out alternative models of analyzing phenomena. And each of these models can give you insights. And Weber talked about ideal types.
Right.
That is, you can take a model that would look at politics as exchange. You explain some part of politics. Public choice explains some part of politics. Maybe an important part. It's not the be-all and end-all explanation by a long shot.
Right.
The pure conflict model explains a part of politics, but again, it's not the be-all, end-all. The coercive model explains. Even the ideal theory benevolence model
right.
explains a part of politics. So you look at, you use every model you can possibly have and you apply it to the phenomena that's out there. And the same thing is true of markets, the same thing is true of any institution. And to be sure, and that I think is important to recognize, because a lot of people who criticize public choice or who are in favor of public
yep.
choice somehow slip into the assumption that you're trying to explain everything. You're not
yes.
trying to explain everything. You're trying to explain some elements of what you observe.
Right.
And that's where you make terrible mistakes when you jump too quickly into this empirical nonsense.
Right. Let's talk about the empirical nonsense.
Yeah,
so, you know,
yeah.
I mean, one of the features of a lot of economics yeah. these days is its econometric orientation. You don't approve of that. You often been very critical of that mm-hmm. in print and elsewhere. Is it because you're testing, as it were, propositions lodged within a particular
yeah.
paradigm?
Is exactly, that exactly. And you're assuming that somehow that paradigm is dominant over everything else.
Right.
And that need not be the case. Now, in many cases where it becomes obvious that it is the dominant paradigm, you can use the empirics if you want to. And again, to use a Frank Knight term, you're proving water runs downhill again.
Right.
It's obvious that certain things will happen if you do certain things, so you test it out, and that's fine. But to push it out the edges and then sort of try to do this empirical testing and look at real-world data when you have a very mixture of things, of models that go into explaining, and then to sort of say, well, no, you didn't explain it, that you shouldn't have tried to explain it all.
Right.
This is where I think, and this is a rather critical difference here, this is where I think I'm a fan of experimental economics and I'm negative on econometrics.
Right.
Or empirical
right.
economics. Because with experimental economics, they put people in situations, they look at the, and if they're imaginative, they're interesting situations, and they see what comes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't necessarily lock themselves implicitly or explicitly into a particular paradigm.
You mentioned earlier your prodigious reading.
Mm.
And I wanted to pick up one aspect of that, mm. also from the University of Chicago days, which is the story about how you, as it were, met Fixell. So would you mind
yeah.
telling us that
yeah.
story? That I'll...
Well, that's a familiar story, anybody who's listened to me much. Because the dominant influences on my career, my thinking, have been two, Frank Knight and Knute Vixell. Frank Knight was my teacher and my role model and everything else. And Vigsel, I got through reading Vigsel. Knud Vigsel, of course, was a well-known Swedish economist who was born, I believe, about 1851, died in 1926, covering that roughly the turn of century period. And as students in at Chicago, as graduate students, we knew about Vigsel, but we didn't know anything about him having written in public finance at all, or public economics. As it turns out, however, Vigsel had written his dissertation written it after some of the other books, in 1896, called Finanztheoretische Untersuchungen, which would be called Investigations in Public Finance. And one part of that book, one third of that book, was on the pure theory of taxation. And I just happened by chance on that book. I had finished my German reading exam, which at that time was required of all PhD students. You had to learn to read German. And I had finished my thesis, my dissertation, so I had a couple of months before I was going to a first job. And I was just spending the time in the old Harper Library at the University of Chicago, and happened to pull down this very slight Vigsel volume off the shelves, and may have even seen it before, for all I know, but it hadn't made any impression.
Right.
Took it over to my desk and started reading it, and literally it was as if the scales fell off my eyes, because here was a man saying what I sort of had implicitly felt should be said. But would never have dared articulate. And what he did was essentially develop this notion of somehow the exchange process through taxation. He was trying to extend the neoclassical notion of efficiency to the public sector.
Right.
Now, some others had tried that in Europe. Continental writers were way ahead of the English language writers at this level, and he was simply trying to extend this notion of allocative efficiency to the public sector. Right. Under what kind of conditions then would you be sure that taxing and spending was giving you an efficient allocation of resources? And he saw that it was necessary to go back and look at how decisions get made. So then he started looking at the rules. You have a legislature, you have legislators, each of whom represents a particular interest. And if you're going to get a guarantee that a project was efficient, you would have to have those legislators, each of whom represented some interest, you'd have to have them agree unanimously, because only then would you be sure that everybody was getting some gravy, everybody was getting a benefit.
Right.
And so he developed the unanimity rule, the idea somehow you need, that was the only real guarantee that you'd have an efficient project.
Right.
And if you allowed variability, there'd always be, if anything was efficient, there'd always be one scheme in which you could generate enough taxes voluntarily to pay for it. So you got a voluntary theory of taxation, so to speak, which would guarantee efficiency. And in a larger sense, Vigsel was finding it necessary to go back and look at the rules for making decisions. So he said, you know, you need to drop the majority rule requirement, move toward the unanimity, at least toward unanimity. And he also said, and this was a big influence on me, economists have got to quit acting as if they're advising benevolent despots, which I've quoted many times. And so that's an example of, in my own experience with Vigsel, is an example of serendipity. That is the principle of serendipity.
Right.
Here I had no intention of doing anything with this, pulled this little book down from the shelf, and here it was just all there, and it's what I wanted to develop. It was implicit in my thinking, but it articulated, it brought it out. I was absolutely determined that then I was going to translate that Vigsel book into English.
In the Vigselian case, unanimity plays this critical benchmark role. And in the calculus of consent, the same idea appears, unanimity, and in general, I guess.
Well, the calculus of consent is a Wexelian implication. It's an implication to the Wexelian argument,
Right.
Yeah.
But there's an interesting move, isn't there, in the calculus of consent? I mean, you've said that Wexel is, in a way, a constitutionalist because he's interested in alternative decision rules and mechanisms. But in one way, what Wexel recommends is an institution which will instantiate exchange, which will be itself an instrument for exchange. Whereas in the calculus of consent, there is the shift of the application of unanimity and the idea of the exchange back to the level of rules, which I suppose you could say loosely is the constitutional element in what people call Buchanan's constitutional contractarianism or contractarian constitutionalism. That move to the level of rules is something that is very distinctive and associated distinctively with you. And I wondered if you might talk a little bit about the influences of that, not only Wexel, but also Rutledge Vining.
Well, first of all, I'm glad you brought that up because that is the central contribution in my evaluation of the calculus of consent.
Sure.
Seems to me what we did, as you said, Wexel was arguing that, look, we need to change the rules, and the only way we can guarantee efficiency is through a unanimity rule.
Right.
Everybody rule that out of court. You can't get unanimity.
Right.
Historically, the Polish attempt to Liberum Veto failed, and how could you ever get unanimity because somebody would always hold out and all. So it's a nonsense, absurd type proposal.
Right.
And yet the logic seemed airtight. So what do you do? And Wexel at least had said, let's look at the rules, but he didn't go beyond that. And he stayed with the sort of, as you said, a one-shot exchange thing. So what we did in the calculus of consent was say, look, it may well be that to get unanimity on a particular spending project, a particular dimension of publicness or politics, is folly to try to think about that. But is it not true that we could move back? We could talk about the level at which we choose the rules.
Right.
Talk about the constitutional level and coming at it from the American context. Constitutions are important; have been thought to be important. And we were thinking Madisonian-type terms, in a way. Is it not possible to sort of take that Wexel schemata, apply it to the level of the Constitution, think of a constitutional convention rather than a legislature, and think of a constitutional convention representing differing interests and coming to agreement on a set of rules? Now, those rules, post-constitutional rules, may well embody majority rules, certainly non-unanimity rules, so you get things done. But everybody is, in a sense, agreeing to the outcomes or the pattern of outcomes because they have agreed at the level of the Constitution. So you apply the unanimity criterion, the Wexel criterion, applied to the constitutional level. And so that's what the calculus of consent did, I think, essentially.
Right. And, I mean, did Rutledge Vining...
Vining point comes in.
He was at the University of Virginia when you went there.
Right. He had been a long time at the University of Virginia. And it turned out that Vining and I shared a lot of common interest in the sense that we had both been influenced a great deal by Frank Knight.
Uh-huh.
And Frank Knight, again, had stressed rules a lot.
Right.
And Vining himself paid a lot of attention to the impact of rules and stressed the point that we don't choose outcomes, we choose rules, and out of which generate patterns of outcomes.
Right.
And so in discussions that we carried on in the Charlottesville period there in the late 1950s, early 60s, Vining was very important in the sense that he was reinforcing my own proclivity to move in the direction of trying to think about rules.
And, of course, I mean, we shouldn't talk about the calculus of consent without mentioning Gordon and Gordon's contribution.
Gordon had spent Gordon Tullock we're talking about here. Yeah. He'd taken a law degree at the University of Chicago, then he practiced law a bit, and then he went in 9 years in the Foreign Service.
Oh, right.
Spent some time in the Far East.
Right.
And then he resigned from the Foreign Service, and he became what he calls the world's only independent scholar for a while. Then we, Warren Nutter and I, set up this Thomas Jefferson Center for Studies in Political Economy and Social Philosophy. We set that up in 1957 in Virginia.
Right.
And the Volcker Fund gave us a 5-year grant to bring in distinguished people to come as lecturers, and also a postdoctoral fellowship.
Right.
And Warren Nutter had known Gordon Tullock as a member of the debate team as undergraduates at Chicago. Shirley Litwin was also on that team. And so he said, well, maybe Tullock would be interested. He's got this manuscript, and he's at Princeton. He's floating around. So we gave him the first postdoctoral fellowship. He came in the fall of 1958 to Charlottesville. And so he spent that year there, and that's how I got to know Gordon Tullock. And then he went off to University of South Carolina in the Foreign Affairs Department down there. Mm-hmm. And we had had enough discussions while he was in Charlottesville that we decided that we were going to start doing some joint work on politics. And he wrote this paper that was later published in the Journal of Political Economy called Problems of Majority Voting.
Right.
And he and I started working back and forth. And out of that came the Caucus of Consent.
Right.
Then he came back to Virginia on the faculty in 1962.
While we're talking about the University of Virginia and the people there, I'd like to talk more broadly about that department, because it was a wonderful time in the history of the public choice movement and in economics generally. I mean, it was an extremely strong and exciting department, and for about 10, 12 years there, it was producing many of the best graduate students in the country and really a very exciting intellectual place. And apart from yourself and Rutledge Vining and Gordon, who we've mentioned, there were a number of others, and I wondered about whether you'd like to say something about Warren Nutter, for example, who was the co-director of the Thomas Jefferson Center.
There was Warren Nutter, and then, of course, we brought in Ronald Coase.
Right.
Yeah, I would like to say something about Warren Nutter, because Warren, I share with him the sort of entrepreneurial plaudits, I guess, for setting up the operation. He and I had been graduate students together at the University of Chicago. We were both members of this group who were socialists and got converted to the market, having spent time in the military before that. And actually, while we were still graduate students, we had said that we needed a place where there would be a center that would sort of try to shift economics back toward its classical foundations. Then 10 years later, we found ourselves pointed to the faculty of the University of Virginia at the same time, more or less. And so we said, let's set something up like this. And we went and we found out that it was very simple. They said, sure, go ahead. Anything you want to do, go ahead. So we set up the Thomas Jefferson Center for Studies in Political Economy and Social Philosophy. And Warren Nutter and I shared, as I say, the entrepreneurial part. I mean, I claim no prime credit, nor would he. We were a genuine joint enterprise.
Right.
And we got some funds, as I said, from the Volcker Foundation and other Earhart Foundation and others to set up this program. We brought in some top visiting lecturers. We brought in Frank Knight and Hayek and Bertil Olin from Sweden, Maurice Allais from France, Bruno Leone from Italy, Michael Pagliani. We brought in a whole stream of distinguished people to give these lectures. And we had these postdoctorals, of which Gordon Tullock was the first. And we began to get very, very good graduate students. We also had some good graduate fellowships to offer. And so we got extremely good graduate students. Externally, by all odds, we were quite successful. But internally, we were not very successful, because we were hated with a passion by the other faculties of the university. And as I said earlier, I don't think modern scholars modern academics can possibly appreciate what went on in those days. And the ideological ferment, ideological intensity was tremendous in the 1950s and 1960s. And we were, as a department, very successful, but on the other hand, we were interpreted by the other Virginia faculty as being right-wing fascist. Wow. We were not deserving of appointment at the University of Virginia. So they were determined to get rid of us, determined to wipe us out, and they finally succeeded. Yeah. So we began to have difficulties, and they set up special committees to investigate us and so forth and so on. And then they made no effort whatsoever to keep Ronald Coase on the faculty. He wanted to stay, didn't want to go to Chicago, made no effort to keep Andrew Winston on the faculty, would not promote Gordon Tullock.
Right.
And finally, we just got fed up, and Coase left, Winston left, I left, Tullock left, and I left, and finally the whole thing broke apart.
Can I take you back to constitutions and rules and so on to ask you a question about constitutions with a capital C and constitutions with a small c, that is, the written documents on the one hand versus the practices and rules of the game more generally on the other?
Well, let me stay with the small c constitution for a bit here. I define the constitution inclusively, small c, as being the set of rules, conventions, traditions within which a society more or less operates, in which people empirically sort of accept as guidelines or framework within which they carry on their ordinary activities, both private and public. Now, in that sense, defined that way, a constitution will always exist.
Sure, exactly.
There are always such traditions. And that's where I bring in this relatively absolute thing again. Uh-huh. That is to say, people treat those as relatively absolutes by comparison with, say, ordinary policy making within those constitutions. Now, again, to go back to what I said about alternative models explaining elements of this, some of that small c constitution no doubt evolves. Traditions have come up. Nobody chose them. They just sort of started being there. I think the Hayek problem that he emphasized too much, the evolutionary aspect of some of this, and neglected the laid on or explicitly constructed designed aspects. Some parts of the constitutions that we live with, small c, are explicitly designed, laid on, constructed, agreed to, which is more or less the contractarian logic. Others may originate in coercion. Somebody may have imposed them on us, like the Japanese constitution that MacArthur imposed on Japan, much of which still exists.
Sure.
So all of these can explain why they're there, but they're there in every country, this set of traditions, rules. But I think it is very, very bad or misleading or has unfortunate implications, I guess I should say, if you concentrate too much on the fact that these rules and traditions simply evolve. I think that takes attention away from the fact that you can also change them. You can change the rules. And after all, if we're interested in reform, we have to think we can change them.
Yep.
Now, it may be difficult to change sometimes, but we don't want to give up in advance, so to speak.
What kinds of provisions would you think ought to be up for debate?
Well, I've been on board for a long time in favor of a balanced budget amendment.
Right.
Now, that doesn't seem so urgent right now since we have surpluses, but I think that's only a temporary thing. And I would like to see a requirement that the government keep its budget in balance.
Right.
I would also like to see, and perhaps this is more important, really, I'd like to see us constitutionalize the monetary structure.
Right.
One way or another. Right. I think leaving things up open to the discretion of a central bank is very, very dangerous.
Right.
And I think that's something that we're making mistakes all over the world in.
Right.
In terms of independence is not what we want,
right.
But we want it to constitutionalize this.
Right.
There are other ambiguities that probably need to be clarified in a constitutional structure. In one sense, and this gets you very far afield in a way, it would have been nice had Madison recognize that you need to keep external markets open as well as internal markets. I mean, you see, his constitution sort of guaranteed that America was going to be a huge open market internally.
Sure.
But he left open the fact that we could squeeze off foreign markets by tariffs. And I'd like to see the economic constitution mended to
I think there are many Australians who would endorse that.
Right, right.
Right. Let's move on to an issue which is of concern to me in the whole constitutional exercise, a kind of tension, as I see it, between agreement at the constitutional level and institutional arrangements that themselves have maximum agreement. And let me take an example and see what you think of this. Just take an issue like the sale of organs, like live kidneys, just to make it sort of really salient. On the face of it, you would think that a market for kidneys is an instantiation of exchange. There are people who want kidneys, there's an undersupply of kidneys, there are people who are prepared to give kidneys up for a price, and if the price is set at zero and it depends on people's goodwill or cadaverous kidneys only, then we won't have enough kidneys to meet the demand. So a proposal comes forward that we should allow the sale of bodily organs. Now, as I understand your position, it is that ultimately the question of whether that involves maximal exchange or not is not the issue. The issue is rather whether we can get consensus on that particular proposal at a constitutional, appropriately constitutional level.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right. There may be exchanges that we simply do not approve of, and we want to, and there are obviously the exchanges that simply are ruled out.
Right.
That we just don't want to allow them to happen. We don't want people to behave that way.
Right.
And so,
right.
The question is, can we agree to more or less agree, reach a substantial consensus on what that list is?
Right.
Now we don't want some people going around saying, well, people shouldn't trade in this and that just because they happen to not like it or they happen to get in charge. But on the other hand, we certainly want, if there's a consensus in favor of preventing these types of exchanges going forward, and organs may be something like that in many cases, but we just don't want it to happen.
Now, I want to go from there to the issue of liberty itself, because one might say that the failure to allow trades in bodily organs or on other margins is an infringement of various persons' liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And your interpretation of liberty and how liberty is to be structured seems to depend on getting constitutional consensus around it.
Yeah.
So how does your libertarianism, which is undoubted, sort of sit with the logic of contractarianism?
No, I acknowledge that there's a tension there. and a possible contradiction there. I could respond in part by saying it's the constitutionalist that is primary and the libertarianism is secondary, but that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
In many cases, libertarianism might trump the constitutionalism in some cases.
Right.
I'm not sure. I don't deny that there is that contradiction here.
Right.
If you could observe a constitutional consensus developing on some restrictions on individual liberty that I might, for example, just be very strongly opposed to, I wouldn't be in the consensus, but you might have an overwhelming body of opinion, and
yes.
that I would. So I don't deny the contradiction or tension or whatever. It's more of a tension, I think.
Right.
Than anything else. Yeah.
Right. Well, Rawls, who we haven't mentioned connection with constitutionalism, but we'll come back to him for a minute. But he has a nice, I think, way of talking about this in terms of the reflective equilibrium notion.
Mm-hmm.
That is that constitutional, contractarian kind of thinking has to be balanced with thinking about the outcomes that it produces, and that both are relevant for the assessment of ideas, and one wants to bring those intuitions at the two different levels together in some ways, so that each disciplines the other. That seems to me to be, it mightn't be totally satisfactory, but it does suggest the kind of tâtonnement between one's substantive intuitions and the discipline of as it were, the constitutional
context. Well, but I think there's a difference here. I think there is a difference between the Rawls position, say, and mine on this.
Right.
In the sense that, whereas I can sense that the tension between the constitutionalist, which is a kind of a logical, structural position, and my own sense of a libertarian position, I would never claim that that is other than my own.
Right.
Whereas Rawls is enough of a Kantian to somehow think that there are these sort of ideal precepts out there that he is searching toward. He's trying to ground that in more than his own personal, ultimate personal values.
Right.
Whereas I would never go beyond that point, I think.
Right.
I think that is a difference.
Right.
Yeah.
Within the libertarian tradition, there are two kinds of arguments that are often in play. One is the consequentialist defense of free markets, the idea that free markets generate wealth. And you've said that that's not really the centerpiece of your own defense of market order. And there is another tradition, isn't there, the rights tradition associated with the work of Bob Nozick, I suppose most conspicuously in recent times, but generally with a libertarian rights position. And generally you've been inclined to distance yourself from that as well. Do you want to say something about that tradition?
Well, I think I'm getting into deep water here in the sense that I haven't thought as much about some of these issues as I would somehow like to think about them. I haven't articulated them well in my own mind. On the other hand, I think that I am, in one sense, closer to the rights tradition than I am to the consequentialist position, or I might put it, rather than put it in terms of rights, let's put it in terms of philosophical terms, deontological position. That is, not a particularized end, not teleological, which is the sort of consequentialist view.
Sure.
On the other hand, I think that where I differ with Nozick and some of the others is that I don't think there is any clearly defined set of rights that you can delineate independently of maybe agreement or contract or constitutionalism. It goes back to that.
I mean, there's one notable distinction between you and Nozick. I mean, Nozick seems to believe in a minimal state.
Yeah.
You believe in a productive state, at least the scope for a productive state.
Yeah.
I mean, that's more in the Vixellian tradition, I guess,
where
the capacity of governments to provide public goods is certainly acknowledged. And you, as I recall, you also say in the review piece that you wrote on Nozick that you thought a very important distinction ought to be drawn between coercion of a rights-reducing kind and redistribution, say, through the state.
Well, I think, first of all, you're right in a sense of saying that Nozick is for the is the minimal state, and my position can be interpreted being allowing for a productive state. I would do that, but I perhaps have changed over time. I think it's less likely that the state as it operates will, in fact, generate public goods. I think mm-hmm. it's more likely to generate public bads.
Right.
So I've moved more toward a minimal or protective state position than I was perhaps 25 years ago or whenever.
Right.
So maybe I'm much more skeptical about the ability of politics and the state to do that. I think, again, to go back to what I said before, I think I differ with Nozick in the sense that he sort of thinks that there are kind of natural boundaries,
yes.
a kind of a Lockean position,
sure.
which I'm much more Hobbesian than he is in that respect.